When I moved into this building here, North Carolina, where the furniture factory was, were for all the major manufacturing of furniture in this country, all of the factories closed down. Outside those factories stood all the Chinese buyers for that machinery to manufacture furniture in China. The minute they shut those doors, they walked in and purchased all that machinery and took it to China to make furniture. And that's why all of the furniture, the American companies that manufacture furniture, get their furniture made in Indonesia, China, and Taiwan. None of it is made in this country. And that has to stop. That's got to stop. They're getting it made for a fraction of the price over there. Way back in the 90s, I worked for a company, an antique shop, who had bought in, by request of a client, had bought in a reproduction set of English Chippendale chairs. The chairs were only 2 years in the apartment. When they split, cracked, they were solid mahogany, carved identical to the English Chippendale chairs. They split, cracked, joints opened, they fell apart. Because first of all, wood has to be killed and dried. In Indonesia, they're not killing drying it fast enough, properly. They're doing it too fast and not properly. So when it comes into centrally heated apartments or houses in this country, within 2 years, the moisture dries out and they fall apart. And they were trying to get them restored, and it's totally impossible to restore them. So that's what you're importing into this country. You're doing people out of their jobs. The companies have closed down. Nobody's been trained how to make furniture because it's all going out to these places who are getting paid $1 a day. And the same applies for a clothing manufacturer because the Americans don't want to work. They come in and they do not want to work. After one guy walked, the last guy I had here and his half brother, this guy had injured his elbow years ago, had fallen off a ladder, 96. He got 250,000 in damages from the company he worked for. He went to work for another local company, fell off the ladder again, broke the elbow again, got another $200,000 in damages. Came to work here for me. He had two speeds, dead stop and slow. Eventually, after 2 years working here, and they got paid very well, 2 years working here, he decided the weather outside was too cold on his elbow, and his elbow pained him, so he wasn't coming into work anymore. His half brother, who, if someone dropped a hammer, went home sick. If someone yelled, went home sick. If something fell, he went home sick. He was 18 years of age. He decided he'd walk out too, so I was left with nobody. I had fired the other two kids for doing drugs and being drug dealers into the back of the shop. So he went home. He tried to get unemployment, took me to court. His complaint was, I harassed him to make him work. You're right. He had with him, his witness was the guy who worked in my shop, in my office, who had a dog. I don't mind dogs coming in here. I let him bring his dog in because the dog would have been on his own all day. So I said, bring him in. We had to close that door because the dog was begging off the guys on the floor and he was getting fat. So the guy with the elbow, his bench was about probably where that desk was. That door was closed. So his witness, who was the guy who worked in the office, said, yes, he heard me harassing him to work. I said, really? I said, what did you bring in to work? I said, what do you mean? I said, what did you have with you every day to work? He says, what do you mean? I said, didn't you have a dog? He said, yeah. I said, didn't you close the door because the dog was getting fat from getting fed from the guys on the floor? He goes, yeah. So I said, how could you hear me? The judge threw it out of the court. Another girl had a cough when she came in here. She tried to get workman's comp, said that she had, because of the fumes in the shop, she called OSHA. OSHA came in here. Went around, checked everything out. She said, Girl, Barbara Moshe said, "I don't find anything wrong here." Well, I said, "You know what? I'd like you to test the atmosphere to make sure there's nothing in it." So I said, "You know, come back sometime." So she came back at the beginning of February after the shop was shut for, was all the windows and everything was closed for the whole winter. Done a test. Nothing here to cause anybody to cough. After the whole situation went through, going through about a year after going through all my stuff for my accountant, I discovered the guy in the office was writing checks to himself, signing them with my name, and cashing them, hundreds of dollars. And he was the evidence for this guy. I do lectures with organizations. I had done a number of lectures with the architectural restoration organization, and I had done a lecture in Boston. So about 2 years after that lecture, I get a phone call, and this guy says, "We have somebody here who's applied for a job, has given me your name as a reference." I said, "Really, who would that be?" Gave the name. I said, "Really?" I said, "I've no comment." Well, he said, "He doesn't know I know you." He said, "You done a lecture here 2 years ago for us," and he said, "I took your course." I said, "Okay." And he said, "He's applied for a job here." I said, "What do you do?" He said, "We make all the display units for the tradespeople." I said, "Would he be climbing the ladder?" He said, "Oh yeah, he has to climb a ladder." "Really? Well, then I'll tell you. The guy who broke his elbow, who had taken me to court saying I harassed him to make him work, went to Boston and gave my name as a reference." And I said, "Okay, I'll tell you then. This is what happened." So that's what I deal with as an employer, whether it's because I'm a woman or a foreigner or it's just general practice for an employer. But I gather it's general practice because a friend of mine, he was the one who walked in the day the guy walked out, and he says, "Don't you ever take him back." He says, "This is what he does." And he had gone to Boston not knowing that we're all known in this field. Everybody knows everybody else. So that's what you have to deal with when you're employing people, and it has to change. People have got to want to work. When the likes of myself come out here, or other people come in, Mexicans, South Americans, whatever, we all work. We're happy to work. But unfortunately, the work ethics has to change with American people. Want the country to survive. It's all part of the whole gamut to make this country be a success. So it has been very interesting. Yeah, but there he was. He's writing checks to himself. Signing with my name a year later. But he gave evidence. False evidence. Actually, the judges threw it out of court. And that girl with the cough, what she didn't tell them was her husband's brother-in-law was he Iranian or Arab or somebody, and they lived out there, and he owned this house. And the deal for them was the husband, who was construction worker, was to replace the heating system, and he was dragging out asbestos out of that basement. And she told me he was dragging out asbestos, and it was dry. You have to wet asbestos to move it, but he was dragging it out dry, and they were doing it before she came here to work. So my philosophy is tell the truth, give the facts, stick to the facts. And then her cousin who worked here at the same time, she piped up and said, "Oh, I'm a TB carrier." And then this girl said, "Well, we're not related." But you know what, honey? TB is not transferred through genetics, it's transferred through the air. So it's just fascinating what you have to go through, you know? And you do have to face discrimination. I had to face it in Sotheby's with John Stair. It was, just horrific, but it's part of the whole growth. And we as immigrants, I feel sorry for people that come in and don't speak English. They really have to speak English. I've had worked with people and they refuse to speak English. They continue to speak Spanish. I'm not going to speak. You're working in this country, then the national language is English. Don't you? Why are you here then? Go home if you're not going to speak English. But it's very difficult because your system is very different here. So I have to learn a whole new system and how things operate. You take everything for granted over in Ireland. Well, this is how it is. You go in, you go, yeah, well, yes or no. That's how it is. Because it's such a tiny country, everybody knows. And as I said, it's no point telling lies because everyone knows. So you expect the same system to work here, and it doesn't. And it's very difficult. Very difficult to get to know. And people scare the hell out of you. You're always terrified. You were terrified of the IRS, and you were terrified of the accountants, and you were doing it because everybody done this, and you can't do that. And there was no fact to it at all. So you're treading on eggshells all the time because you don't know. I was employed by Sotheby's. I was sponsored by Sotheby's, so I couldn't work anywhere else. I had to stay with Sotheby's. So John Stair refused to get my green card for me because he didn't want me working anywhere else. And then the INS told him he has to get a green card or they're not going to issue another visa for me. And he refused. And then he'd yell at me, we're going to send mother, he always called me mother, we're going to send mother home to pick potatoes. He would yell that at me. He would yell at me, you're the oldest thing on the floor. Really, John, you're older than me. You know, so I had to put up with a massive amount of discrimination and abuse from him and Sotheby's. And if Sotheby's, we tried to complain. I wasn't the only, there was other women there that he would, the things he would say to them and people he would say it to them. But if you, we complained to Dee Dee Brooks, she ignored it because she was mixed up with him. She was eventually caught with her hand in the cookie jar. So we as immigrants have a lot to deal with when we come here. And it's really, you get ripped off by immigration attorneys. They don't do their job and they charge you huge money and you don't know any different. And then they're scaring you. Well, if you don't do this, they're going to send you home and you can't come back to the country. But that's not true. That's not fact. That's not fact. I have friends who are immigration, who were immigration federal agents. And I know the difference now. I've investigated. When I came here in 87, in 86, in the end of 86, beginning of 87, there was 125,000 Irish illegal immigrants in Manhattan, in New York. All of them highly educated, and they were being employed in restaurants and things like that. The owner of the restaurants were taken, of course, when we paid them $2 an hour, and were taken part of their tips and told them that they couldn't leave, that if they did, that they turned them into the INS and they would be deported. So there were two guys, two Cork chaps, one was legal, one was illegal, and they started an organization called the Irish Immigration Reform Movement, and it was to get visas for the Irish in America. In 1960, Robert Kennedy cut back the visa quote to Europe, including Ireland, to 360 visas per country per year. And to get the South American vote, to get the Spanish vote for John F., he gave 20,000 visas per year per country to South American countries. So these two kids, they didn't want to change the 20,000, they wanted the Irish to get the same. So a senator called Brian Donnelly picked up the case and he went and got passed in Congress 40,000 visas per year for Ireland alone for Irish immigrants. And it started to clear all the illegal Irish immigrants in here in this country. When I moved upstate, I became the chairperson of the Irish Immigration Reform Movement. And I was the chairperson here in Albany and I had to speak. There was a Father Hines who run a big concert every year with the wolf tones. And one of the wolf tones happened, him and his wife happened to be clients of mine in Dublin. And the wolf tones played at this concert every year and raised thousands and thousands of dollars for young Irish. And one of the recipients of a fund from that was the Irish Emigration Reform Movement, and I was the chairperson to speak at that organisation at that concert. And I remember going up, knocking on the door of the green room or dressing rooms, wherever they were, up in the plaza up there, and I said, "Can I speak to Muller?" And of course they go, "Hey, Muller! Hey, missus, you can't go in there. All them girls are naked." I said, "It's not the first time I saw a naked man." "Hey, Muller, there's a woman here to see you." And he looks at me, "What the hell are you doing here?" I said, "Never mind me, what are you doing here?" So he had heard I'd gone to America, you know, so it was interesting that our paths crossed. But anyway, they made raised thousands of dollars for the Irish, and Irish emigration were part of the recipients of that. So John Stair refused to get me a green card. So I applied. I was doing this, putting the school together at the time, and Jennifer was at a dinner party and she happened to let it slip and Stair hit the ceiling. So he was determined to get me put out of the country. He'd done everything, and I had politicians fighting him. A lot of people fighting him to stop it. So anyway, I applied for a Brian Donnelly visa and got it. Never told him until I had done all the stuff. I had to go back to Ireland to do my medical and all of that over there because the immigration attorney I had never put in an I-90 slip that should be in my passport. Because I wouldn't have had to go back to Ireland to do it. But anyway, I did. Never told him until the week. Can I speak to you, John? Actually, Colin, his son, is Stair Galleries. Colin was my apprentice. I was supposed to be my apprentice, but all he ever done was walk around. But he's a good guy. Colin's a decent guy. And I know him since he was 19. So anyway, I said Colin was the manager at that point. And I said, "Colin, your father's coming up today. Can I speak to him?" And he says, "Okay." So the only time I ever wanted to speak to John Stair was to threaten to sue his ass off for something he'd done. He'd done it twice. And I threatened him if he'd done it again, I would sue his ass off and I'd sue Sotheby's. So anyway, he come back out, face red, and he says to me, "Will I do?" And I said, "No." I said, "You can be there, but," I said, "it's your father I want to speak to." So he come up and he come into the office. John is sitting one to my right, Colin's to my left, and I went the full hog. I said, "John," I said, "I'm leaving to go to Ireland next week. I got an MP5. "What the F is an MP5? "It's a green card. How the did you get that?" I said, "Well, this is how I got it." I thought he was going to have a heart attack. So he turns to Colin and he says, "So that means you won't be leaving," because he had given me an ultimatum to leave or be fired. And I said, "Well, I won't be leaving America." He says to me, he turns to Colin and he says, "You better tell that other polisher coming in from that school, Bennett, whatever." I said to him, "North Bennett Street School in Boston. How the F do you know that?" "Oh, I visited North Bennett Street School many times because I researched all the schools around to make sure what they were doing and what I wanted to do." So I thought he was going to have a stroke. So he asked me to leave. I said, "Fine." And I got my green card. And we never spoke from the day we left. And I saw him. Talk about karma. I saw him one Thursday. Sotheby's fired him. They fired him by faxed eventually for something he had done. But anyway, I saw him crossing the road one day. Now, at this time, I'm a citizen a number of years when I saw him. And I'd done a double take. And I called my daughter. She worked for Tom Noonan at the time. I said, "I've just seen John Stairs. John Stair, and he's dying." She says, "Mom," I said, "I'm telling you, that man is dying." That Sunday, he was coming back from Millbrook or somewhere. He had a grandfather clock in the back of his van and two big ginger jars. And he must have had a heart attack because he never braked. He went smack into the tree and the clock shot forward and decapitated him. So he must have had a heart attack. So John Colin later said to me that he wouldn't go, well, like, because I knew what he was like, he wouldn't go to a doctor. He drank a bottle of Durez a day. So, you know, he said he had a lump on his leg that was big as a soccer ball, and he wouldn't go to a doctor, so he must have had a heart attack. That's how I got my green card, and then I got my citizen. Had to wait 5 years to get my citizenship, and I got that here. So that was my great day. But it was very funny. I was presented with my certificate of citizenship up in the courts up here in Albany, and of course I had a bunch of my friends there out at the federal building, and my name is Mary Dimpney Keegan. My daughter's Mary Denise Keegan, and that was the confusion where the whole thing with the credit. But anyway, they called Mary Keegan from Columbia, and I, of course, and then my friend Beth says, "Hey, he's calling you," because she knew what my full name was. And so I go up and I said to him, "I'm not from Columbia, I'm from Columbia County." I said, "You'll probably arrest me now as a drug dealer." They all start laughing. These are all the top judges in New York State. So I'm walking back down. This guy pops up. "Are you from Columbia?" "No," I said, "I'm Columbia County. I'm Irish." "I didn't think you were," he said. So, you know, but it was interesting. So as an immigrant, we have a lot to go through and we've a lot to understand, and you get scared to hell with what people tell you. And then as you go through life, you realize it's their interpretation of what they believe and what they have gone through. So it's coloring their knowledge, and then they impart it wrongly to somebody else. And that applies even as I said, as a medium. You have to prevent your experience from coloring your reading, because your experience is very different to that person's. There's nothing in common with it. So that's why we train them in PSI. And that's, once again, that's the caution. Because I've had people who come and say to me, "Oh, I wouldn't go for a reading. I don't want to know when I'm dying or so." No, we can't tell you when you're dying. We can't tell you when anyone else is dying either, because that's not our liberty. That's not information we're given, because that's the person's own decision. They may not have made up that decision when they're going to die. They may, you know, so that's that person's subconscious decision. This is your consciousness is your floppy disk. Your subconscious is your hard disk drive. That's what computers are based on. So you have to reprogram the hard disk drive. This you can change anytime you want to, but that's your subconscious is what you have to change. So that's what basically everything in life rotates around. In your life, what you want, do you know what you want? Making up your mind what you want. And you take it from there. So it's training people. So thank you very much.
Thank
You made a mistake asking me to
No,
talk.
I got it. This is great.
You made a mistake asking me to talk.